Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. When was the last time you heard a really good discussion of the federal budget? Been a while, right? Well, worry no more. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 19th of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. President-elect Trump, as we know, has big plans for the American economy. Infrastructure spending and tax cuts top the list. Those two items are going to be of specific and very special concern to South Carolina Congressman Mick Mulvaney. Representative Mulvaney has been named to head the Office of Management and Budget, the agency in charge of making the president's budget work. Mulvaney is a serious deficit hawk, very keen on the idea that if the government is going to do something, the government has got to figure out a way to pay for it. That means he is likely to face some big debt-related problems, some of them created by the man who appointed him. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
You know how the president proposes a budget to Congress each year? Well, the OMB director is the person who writes that up. That could be a really hard job for someone like Representative Mulvaney, who doesn't like deficits.
The fundamental issue he's got to confront is we have a rather significant budget deficit. We have an enormous debt.
Howard Gleckman is at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He says even without any new spending or tax cuts and with some sequestration spending caps still in place, the debt is on track to rise by $5 trillion over 10 years. This is a long-term trend, in part driven by an aging population. The consequences, though, are being felt now.
There's a debt limit which expires in the spring. When that happens, the government is no longer able to borrow money. The current temporary budget expires in April, and they're going to have to decide what to do about that, how to fund the government for the rest of this fiscal year into next fiscal year.
That's a difficult math problem to solve without deficits. Now pile on Trump's campaign promises, tax cuts, infrastructure spending, more defense spending, all projected to add as much as $7 trillion to the debt, according to Gleckman. Jared Bernstein is senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and former member of President Obama's economic team.
So what you really have here is the collision between this Trump fiscal agenda, a ton of red ink, and a guy who supposedly stands strongly against that sort of thing.
Might be a little bit awkward. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The politics of North Carolina are interesting right now. There's what's being called the legislative coup of last week, state lawmakers passing and the outgoing Republican governor signing legislation to limit the powers of the incoming Democratic governor. Today, though, this happened. The Charlotte City Council voted to repeal a local anti-discrimination ordinance, a law that was cited by state lawmakers as a reason for passing the now infamous North Carolina HB 2, better known as the bathroom bill, the one that required transgender people to use restrooms corresponding to their birth certificates in many buildings. Now that Charlotte has repealed its law, state lawmakers say they will repeal HB 2, which has cost, as you know, the state millions in lost corporate, entertainment, and sports businesses. Marketplace's Rima Crace reports now on what the state might expect as it tries to get that business back.
Ziad Flahan says he doesn't even want to think about how much business he's lost since HB 2 was passed in March. Since then, at least six conventions have been pulled from Greensboro, where he runs Gassan's famous steak subs.
And then the concerts are the other scary thing. You know, like Bruce Springsteen, no, we would have done that. That was a few thousand.
Flahan says all told, lost sales come to at least 20,000. Make that 20 million, and that's roughly what the city of Greensboro itself has missed out on, between concerts, conventions, championship games. Over in Raleigh, Jeff Merritt is with Centennial Authority, which oversees PNC Arena. It lost a big chunk of concert business, too, including Demi Lovato and Maroon 5. But looking ahead, Merritt expects that business to pick back up, and Raleigh has put in a lot of bids for NCAA sporting events.
With full repeal, I think we're back in the running for those, and those are extremely lucrative, not just from a physical perspective, but from a prestige perspective.
North Carolina's image as a progressive state has been tarnished, says Democratic Representative Greg Meyer.
It makes you wonder how people will look at us for a long, long time. How long does it take for us to live this down? In terms of companies, I think that there are a lot of corporations that have been waiting to see what was going to happen with HB2, and this will be very, very positive news.
Adrienne Cole is executive director of Wake County Economic Development. She says the state got hit with a lot of corporate protest by companies like PayPal and Salesforce. But with repeal, she says hopefully they'll reconsider. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was up a bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With most of the cabinet-level jobs filled, the Trump transition team is working its way down the organizational chart. The president-elect announced today he is going to nominate Vincent Viola as Secretary of the Army. Viola is a financial entrepreneur. He was once the chair of the New York Mercantile Exchange, and he owns the NHL's Florida Panthers to boot. Trump Tower is making much of his business experience, saying it makes him well-positioned to lead, quote, a Fortune 10-sized company, the U.S. Army, end of quote. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at how or whether one might want to run the American Army like a business.
I'm going to start with a question. Is the Army a business?
Yes and no.
That's Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute. She says yes, because the Army has a large workforce that has to be managed, but no, because it's not out to make a profit. And the Army's mission to protect the country doesn't exist in the business world. Another thing, the Army's board of directors is Congress, and Congress wants to protect jobs back home. So
when individuals start talking about running the Defense Department like a business, Congress gets nervous and they hear job losses.
So Eaglin says Army secretaries have to be politically savvy. Gordon Adams is a professor emeritus at American University. He says Vincent Viola would be frustrated if he tried to run the Army like a business, not only because of Congress. If confirmed by the Senate, Viola would also have to deal with Army bureaucrats.
They've been around before Vinnie Viola. They'll be around after Vinnie Viola. And they will probably continue to run the Army pretty much the way they have.
Army bureaucrats are powerful. Chuck Spinney has seen that firsthand. He's a former Pentagon analyst.
Basically, what you have is a bureaucratic system that's driven by a five-year planning system, just like the old Soviet Union.
In other words, super centralized. Spinney says central planners make buying decisions for those five-year budget plans. Oh, and the Army secretary isn't part of the chain of command, so can't give orders or fire military staff. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We put together a guide to all of the president-elect's cabinet and sub-cabinet picks and their corporate connections. It's at trumpcabinet.org. Let me say it again, trumpcabinet.org. Check it out. It's pretty cool. All right, moving on. Remember that $14.5 billion judgment against Apple over the tax arrangement that the company made with Ireland? The European Union's Competition Commissioner ruled this past summer that Ireland had done a deal with Apple that let it pay pennies on the dollar in taxes compared to what it actually owed, and that said deal was illegal and unfair. Apple filed its appeal today. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains where things might go from here.
The EU is claiming Apple paid a less than 1% tax rate in 2014. Ireland's standard tax rate is 12.5%. But the EU said Apple paid very little through a sweetheart deal that included subsidies and tax loopholes. Ireland is fine with it. Steve Rosenthal is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute.
Ireland is in the unusual spot of arguing that the deal with Apple ought to be respected, and Ireland does not want to collect these 12.5% tax.
Apple employs thousands of people at its European headquarters in Cork, Ireland. Diane Ring is a professor at Boston College Law School. She says the EU is trying to ensure that member states aren't gaming the system.
The debate is whether it's sort of too good a deal.
Apple says it's being singled out and issued a statement that it is the largest taxpayer in the world. Edward Kleinbard teaches law and business at USC. He says there's a reason this was the case the European Commission singled out.
If you look at the actual facts, they're terrible facts against Apple. Apple had a company that barely existed even on paper.
He says through this special deal with Ireland, Apple was able to funnel money there that got taxed nowhere. But Ireland isn't the only EU member state that has set up special deals with multinational companies. Luxembourg and the Netherlands are also anxiously awaiting this case's final ruling, which could come as early as this week. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A lot of the conversation about the change of administrations and how that is going to affect businesses has been on the very big picture issues, corporate taxes and regulations and Obamacare. But corporate America is way more than just the multinationals, you know. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace went to Ohio and talked to two small business owners with very different takes on what is coming.
Meet a small business owner who's looking forward to January 20th.
Hi, I'm Greg Knox with Knox Machinery.
We're in his showroom. He sells highly automated machine tools for cutting specialized parts for cars, weapons, medical supplies. Right now, one of his display machines is being used for personal reasons, etching out a nativity scene onto little rounds of metal for the office Christmas party.
So Doug is working on making very expensive Christmas ornaments.
Knox employs about 50 people in the suburbs of Cincinnati, and his business is fine, but he says
the number of jobs I've seen leave this region because of the bad trade agreements that Donald Trump has been talking about are just staggering.
He's counting on Trump to even the playing field for American manufacturers, his customers, by strong-arming China on currency issues and raising tariffs on imports. But tariffs could actually hurt his business.
Is it a sticky wicket? Of course. It's 2016. We just looked out of my showroom. You know, the Kitamura machine on the left is made in Japan. The Hyundai across the aisle is made in Korea.
He's most excited about the tax cuts. Trump has proposed cutting business taxes from 35 to 15%. He says that would go straight to his bottom line and allow him to hire more.
I promise you, there'll be more service vans in that parking lot. There'll be more people buzzing around this office.
Business overall has been expanding in this area. And as part of trying to drive economic growth, the Dayton-Cincinnati region has also embraced immigrants and refugees. But Knox says he doesn't have any immigrants working here, and he's enthusiastic about a wall on the border with Mexico and a possible ban on Muslims entering the U.S.
It's a return to nationalism, and many of us, Lewis, especially us older farts like me, we're okay with nationalism.
Just up I-75 in Dayton's quiet south suburbs, immigration and its economic effects are more visible. There are Mexican grocery stores, a Lebanese restaurant, and neighborhoods that have become a bit more racially diverse. Diana Rangel and her husband both run their own businesses as independent contractors in Centerville. She's a private Spanish tutor. He does roofing. And they're both Mexican-American U.S. citizens. She says she doesn't think Trump will be good for them.
I feel as a small business owner that he's not. I feel quite the opposite.
She voted for Clinton, partly because she's really worried about Obamacare, which covers them and their kids. She makes more than $60 an hour now as an independent contractor. He makes more than $20. But if they lose their health care, one of them might have to go work for someone else. She's been looking at classified ads and says the jobs they could get pay a lot less.
I'm happy with my insurance, but now I'm worried about what's going to happen.
She's also scared about how the racial climate has changed. Right after the election, her daughter came home from high school one day.
And she said this random girl walked up to me and started screaming and said, "Go back to your country."
Her husband was born in Mexico. She says he's been questioned multiple times recently by potential customers about his immigration status. She's worried he'll have a harder time getting work.
So yes, racism has been around since, you know, forever. But the way that it's presented now is a lot different.
She says Centerville is a welcoming community for immigrant-run businesses now, but she's worried that could change. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And then once we had something we liked, we gave it to the effects house that then actually built the effects and the picture to the music.
What do the music for Game of Thrones, Westworld, and Iron Man have in common, do you suppose? Well, that guy you just heard, for one thing. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 39 points on this Monday, 0.2%, 19,883. The NASDAQ up 20 points, about 0.3%, 54.57. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.2%, closed at 22.62. Retail stocks advanced on this last shopping week before Christmas. Target struck up 0.3%. Walmart up 0.8%. JCPenney also rolled up about 0.8%. Disney up 1.3%. Rogue One, of course, brought in an estimated $155 million in worldwide ticket sales over the weekend. American Railcar Industries rolled up 4.4%. The company, controlled by investor Carl Icahn, is selling its leasing business to Japan's Sumitomo. Phone companies rang higher as income-chasing investors went in search of higher dividends. Sprint up about 2.4% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.54%. And you, yes, you, right there. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a study out today in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine. It's kind of interesting. It shows that hospital patients who are treated by a female physician live longer, statistically anyway, than patients treated by male physicians. From our help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Listen to this. Two different doctors talking with two different patients at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. First, here's Dr. Kerry Reynolds.
While we're here, the biggest thing we want to do for you is to make sure we've looked through everything.
Yes.
And that we don't leave any stone unturned.
Okay.
Now, listen to Dr. Ryan Thompson.
Let us know if we're not doing a good job.
Yes.
You know, we can always do better.
It's really hard to tell a difference, right? But research out today says there might be something different between how women and men practice medicine. Elderly patients treated by female physicians have a 5% better chance of living after getting out of the hospital. Put another way, if you were to replace all the male doctors in the study with women, 32,000 fewer people would die a year.
I think the most surprising thing is that we found something. You know, why would gender matter?
That's Dr. Anupam Jenam, one of the study authors. It's surprising in part because there's been a push for equality in the field. And here come these results that threaten to upend that modern ideal with data. The results are based on 1.5 million hospital patients and 58,000 doctors. But even with that, Jenna says they wanted to be sure, so the team checked obvious explanations, like women keeping their patients in the hospital longer, different post-hospital referrals, or just spending more money.
None of those things emerged.
This is the first large study to look at how gender impacts patient outcomes. And one thing to keep in mind, the effect is modest. Dr. Vineet Arora at the University of Chicago breaks down what that means.
The way that you would think about that is if you were hospital administrator and you were to reassign 149 patients to female physicians, then you might see this benefit of one life saved.
That kind of impact may explain why most patients and staff I talked to at Mass General shrugged when I asked if they saw a difference between men and women. What did come up was the difference between good and bad doctors. Patient Tracy Nifford has seen a lot of both. She's been to the hospital 30 times this year with an infection she can't get in front of. Nifford got tired of fighting with doctors over things like sending her home with antibiotics that didn't work.
I was at a point in my life that I said, you know what, I'm done.
With this study, it's easy to get stuck in some war of the sexes debate. But this is about the best way to practice medicine so all physicians can do better by their patients. Nifford says it's enough to be sick and scared. There's no room for doctors to make life harder.
As far as getting this fixed, I didn't know what I would do. I was basically at my ropes, you know, the end of my rope. Couldn't take it anymore.
For Nifford, what matters is doctors who listen are empathetic and generous with time. And research suggests women doctors tend to do that better than the men. But Jenna's instinct tells him what's driving this statistical difference is how female physicians tend to approach problems and make decisions. He compares it to how he and his wife would rent a car and a car seat for their toddler.
The way I do that is I Google, find the first thing that comes up, and then I make a decision. She will go through probably 5 to 10 different web pages, and look through all the Yelp reviews.
This study is not definitive. It's a thread to pull to better understand the qualities that make up the best doctors. And odds are, that means looking more closely at the women than the men. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
So here's a little clip of music by way of setting up this next segment. Sadly, we've got a ways to go yet before the next season of Game of Thrones, whence that music comes, summer of next year, according to HBO. But in the meanwhile, how about a chat with a composer of the score for Game of Thrones and a bunch of other TV shows and movies you will recognize? Ramin Djawadi is his name. Ramin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Are you okay that the first line of your obituary is going to be the guy who composed the Game of Thrones theme?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a good way to go?
Exactly, yeah.
We're going to talk about all the other stuff you've done, but and this is sort of a macro question. How does one get a job as a composer?
It's a good question. I mean,
shaking his head. He's like,
yeah,
I don't know.
It's all a blur to me at this point. I mean, I just I started with, I guess, in the traditional sense as an assistant and just kind of worked my way up.
As a composer's assistant?
Correct. Yeah, as a composer's assistant. And in the beginning, I wasn't even composing any music. It was more about handling the all the technical aspects that are in a musical studio. So it was actually a really good thing because when I first moved to LA, I was all eager and I thought, I'm a composer, I'm ready to go. Yeah. But if they had set me down on that chair and said, okay, write this piece of music
and
it's going to be done tomorrow, I think I would have absolutely failed because I just didn't know all the technology and didn't know how to write to picture and how, you know, that's something that fitting music to picture, that's a whole another process that I think it takes a while to learn.
All right, so let's talk about music to picture for a second. Westworld. I don't watch it because I don't do scary things and Westworld is vaguely disturbing. But I watched the opening sequence before we came in here, and we're going to play a little bit of it, and then I want you to talk me through it. It's a bunch of robots making a skeletal creature that then you know is going to become sentient somehow. But anyway, we'll play the music and then we'll talk about it. That you're bobbing your head along. You're like, I recognize this. How did it work? Did when you got this job based on Game of Thrones and all that other stuff, did they sit you down and say, here are the pictures, write music to this? Did they say we need a theme? I mean, how does it go?
With the main title, it was actually quite different because it as you mentioned, it's animated. So it actually didn't exist when I was writing it. So we just discussed it conceptually. And we knew we wanted the piano because in Westworld, the piano plays a big
role.
Right.
It's a player piano. I mean, it's one of those
Correct.
Automatic things.
Yeah. Exactly. So I wrote a piece that was on the piano. And then once we had something we liked, we gave it to the effects house that then actually built the effects and the picture to the music, and including actually taking a video of my hands.
Are those your hands
that then are scaled to it?
Oh, that's so cool.
So the notes are actually playing.
Oh, that's very cool.
It matches, yeah.
But you know what's interesting? If you put the Westworld theme and Game of Thrones back to back, you can tell they're the same guy. Or at least I can. You don't?
Sure. I mean, maybe that's a good thing. I mean, it's...
when you sit down and you have that blank screen or that blank piece of paper, how do you go about filling the page, if that makes any sense?
It's a scary... Or the most scary part every time when I start a project, it's that the beginning always takes the longest. Once you have your themes established and you can work with them, then it's a different part of the process, but it's hard.
One of the things I learned, and I'm a fan of Game of Thrones, and I should have known this, I guess, was that like each character has their own theme, and at climactic moments you have those themes intersecting, and I wonder how, obviously it's intentional, but how difficult is it for you to make all those character-based themes line up when the action requires?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. The way we did it was we just kind of looked at it per season and said which characters have a big story arc this season, and does this character need its own theme, or can we just stay with the family theme? And then every season we kind of expanded from there. So it's kind of a math problem that's kind
right.
Of
and you've got the Jon Snow thing, and then the whole deal, which is cool. So the Westworld soundtrack is now on iTunes. You are going on tour with the Game of Thrones score in February, right?
Mm-hmm.
You are an enterprise now.
Sure.
Kind of. I mean, you're shrugging, but yeah.
The fact that we're doing a music tour with Game of Thrones, with the performing the music, is incredible. And, you know, I would never thought that we would be able to do something like that. It's very exciting.
Well, listen, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
Another of Ramin's composing credits, by the way, the Iron Man movie, which gets us to a little project we did. Have you ever wondered what Marketplace might sound like if superheroes were real? Well, just in time for your vacation listening pleasure, we present Marketplace, the superhero show. We had some fun with it, so give it a listen. It's at marketplace.org. Let us know what you think. This final note on the way out today comes to us from Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people. Their word of the year for 2016, surreal. Searches for it peaked several times this year, apparently. Brexit, the Cubs winning the World Series, also Election Day. Other words in the running, bigly and deplorables. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 39 points on this Monday, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 20 points, about 0.3%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.